Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, 17th of April 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And we're going to start with, an article in the New York Times. But to lead into that, then, we've got Deborah Hines here, who tweeted this out this morning. Images supplied by UK government of hospitalised children and dead ducks affected by Novichok attack on Skripals were used by CIA's Gina Haspel to help persuade real Donald Trump to overcome skepticism and expel 60 Russian diplomats from the US. So this is what Deborah Hines was tweeting out as fact yesterday morning. Really fantastic stuff. So what's she talking about? Well, it is this New York Times article. Gina Haspel relies on spy skills to connect with Trump. He doesn't always listen. And if we look at some of the text here, what it says is, during the discussion, Ms. Haspel, then Deputy CIA Director, turned towards Mr. Trump. She outlined possible responses in a quiet but firm voice, then leaned forward and told the President that the strong option was to expel 60 diplomats. And of course, they're talking about the response to the Skripal attack. To persuade Mr. Trump, according to people briefed on the conversation, officials, including Ms. Haspel, also tried to show him that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were not the only victims of Russia's attack. They went on to say Ms. Haspel showed pictures the British government had supplied her of young children hospitalised after being sickened by the Novichok nerve agent that poisoned the Skripals. She then showed a photograph of ducks that British officials said were inadvertently killed by the sloppy work of Russian operatives. This is pretty spectacular stuff, Patrick, and I don't really know where the issue is here. Is this appalling reporting? Certainly Deborah Hines swallowed this this story hook, line and sinker, it seems. Unfortunately for her, she had to retract slightly, because later on then she was saying this: update, UK security sources say they're unaware of children hospitalised because of Novichok or wildlife killed in Skripal attack. May have been a photo of a dead swan, though not evidence swan was killed by Novichok. If that's true, I wonder what these images used by CIA where. And so don't even know where to start with this. Is this the UK giving the US bogus images in order to firm up their narrative? Is it the US picking images off the internet and trying to persuade a government, a president, that he needs to take action on the basis of false intelligence? Or is this whole thing a piece of fake news by the New York Times?
I think the important point is, the most important point here, Mike, is this claim has been made in the New York Times by the author that the British government supplied images to the CIA, to Gina Haspel, or at least that was reported by Gina Haspel or a CIA liaison or whoever was a source for the story. Has made that claim. So someone is not telling the truth somewhere along the line, Mike, or has Britain flat out denied it supplied those images? Because if they haven't, then that's still a possibility.
Well, Deborah Hines saying that UK security sources say they're unaware of, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It just means that they're unaware of.
Yeah, it means they're unaware of children hospitalized.
Doesn't that mean they're unaware of images, right?
Or dead ducks, yeah. Right. So I think it's quite possible. If you look at this in the context of the Christopher Steele
dossier
and the hoax, the fake dossier, and that was supplied by British intelligence operatives, maybe not officially, say, on the books with MI5 or any of the intelligence agencies, but working in the private capacity, but all ex-agents, Mike, and ex-heads of MI5, like Richard Dearlove, Christopher Steele, etc., the Orbis crew, right? They're feeding the United States with false intelligence, or doctored or sexed up or spun dossiers in order to sort of manipulate and meddle in the U.S. political process.
Well, okay. This raises a whole bunch of issues then. If they're doing this on this, which is respect to expelling some diplomats, what do we know about any intelligence that was given to Trump, for example, to justify bombing Syria?
Well, we'll get to that in a second, Mike. But and then there's the possibility, unless there's a denial by the British government that we didn't supply such images to the CIA, who then showed them to the president to convince him to expel Russian diplomats and sort of increased sanctions on Russia, okay, then the only other possibility is the CIA just fabricated it and showed it to the president, or someone's lying to the New York Times in order to stitch them up. And this story will then collapse in a few days or a week, and they'll blame the journalist for not, for trusting this, whatever their secret source is. So because this is all done in secret, and this is the problem with Spooksville, because everything's opaque and not done transparently, then you have all this sort of potential here for deception and double dealing. And so what it looks like so far, Mike, is that if this is the case, it's also possible that this story is completely fabricated. Mm. Okay, that's a possibility. So, but if it's true, it means that it's a well-oiled machine. It means that the way to get the president to act is via the media. And so this is one of the things that I've gleaned from this article, Mike, is that the president pays a lot of attention to the press.
Even though his rhetoric is all about fake news and
right. So he does actually care what the media is saying, and he'll direct sort of decision making based on what's in the media, what the press is saying. Mm. So in that sense, the deep state is working like a well-oiled machine in the United States, and it's very easy to corner this president just by using the press. So you could fake, you feed and launder fake stories, and the one that Trump listens to the most, and this is the last thing I'll say. Mm. On this point, is Fox News. Mm. So if you can launder a story through a conservative website like Breitbart or The Hill, and you launder it through the websites, it makes it onto Fox. The president sees it, and the president reacts.
Right.
Okay. That's something that I think is probably happening on a weekly basis in Washington. Now, this story, on the other hand, if this is the case, we'll see. We'll see. I'm looking for denials here, Mike. And I'm wondering exactly if this is a psyop. This reminds us of when Trump launched his cruise missile strike in April, I believe, 2017, in the aftermath of the alleged sarin attack in Khan Shaykhun. And we have just a reminder here. This is an article. And Trump's big sort of comment was that, you know, it was the beautiful babies who were so cruelly murdered in this barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Mm. That was the beautiful babies. So he was shown these images, and it compelled him to launch a cruise missile strike against Syria after this alleged chemical attack. And the same in Douma, Mike. He saw the YouTube videos, and the hospital seemed completely fabricated in Douma last year, April 2018, and it compelled Trump to lead the tripartite strike, basically. And maybe his daughter was also crying about the poor babies. Ivanka also pushed him. So I just want to remind people, the author of this article in The Guardian here, this is none other than Luke Harding. This is from April 2017. So these don't forget, it's not just the Russiagate hoaxes that Harding pushed for The Guardian, but he's also their running point on these types of stories as well.
Yes.
So.
Okay, well, obviously, after Monday's news program, this happened, the fire in Notre Dame. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, this was a huge story. This obviously happened on Monday. This was the number one news story. I think it happened, it sort of broke after your news program on Monday, so you weren't able to cover it on Monday's edition. But this is what everyone's really been talking about for the last couple of days here. This is CBS News in the United States. And sort of in the aftermath, Mike, it's been all about the donations, the donation drive to sort of rebuild Notre Dame. And so that's been the real conversation. The billionaires are pledging money, the money's pouring in and so forth. Mm-hmm. And there's candlelight vigils and things like that. But just back to the sort of the fire itself, they managed to save the cathedral's main structure, basically, and including the two towers at that end. You can see that from this image here. But, of course, the spire collapsed, and that part of the cathedral collapsed onto itself. But Parisian authorities are ruling out arson. This is important as a possible terror-related motives are also ruled out. As a possible causes, okay? So it's being treated at the moment, at least, as an accident. This is according to reports by the Associated Press. So we'll take a quick look at the cathedral itself. This is the part in red here. Note the section in red. This is a graphic provided by Reuters. And so this is the part that was lost or damaged that's collapsed onto itself with regard to the Notre Dame Cathedral. So that's the sort of the damage here. And there's been a number of sort of poignant comments made after this. This is, of course, by Craig Murray. This is one of the more insightful comments I've seen on Twitter on this. It said, like other Western states, France possesses incredible technologies, amasses trillions of euros, which could destroy entire cities in moments, and they do, but only invested in two short ladders and hose pipes to safeguard Notre Dame and its built heritage and people, politicians' values, and so forth. So what Murray's trying to say there is that there's nothing invested, there's plenty invested in sort of blowing up cities in Syria, but there's no resources to sort of adequately protect the landmarks for fire. But everybody's coming out holier than now, mm-hmm. all in tears and the candlelight vigils, and it's kind of a joke if you think about it. And you know, a lot of people made comments about this, Mike, and I'm just going to direct people to this. This is a site which I visited in 2017 in Syria in Palmyra, the Temple of Bel. And before and after, ISIS demolished it, basically. So there's before and there's after. This is 6,000 plus years old, mm-hmm. this site, Mike. So, you know, just a slightly a bit older than the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. So in terms of world heritage, I think this is probably one of the biggest things you could find on the planet in terms of a significant world heritage site. Much, much older, thousands of years older than Notre Dame, but very few candlelight vigils or tears were shed when this happened. In fact, it hardly even made the news. So I found that interesting, as well as the number of Christian churches that have been burned in Syria, destroyed, bombed, looted by ISIS, as well as priests and nuns killed, kidnapped, tortured, mm-hmm. and so forth. So it hardly registers in the West, which I find to be quite interesting. But here is something interesting that people might not have picked up. On the same day, a fire broke out in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is the second most holiest site, arguably, in world Islam. And this is in Jerusalem. So a fire broke out. And according to the news reports, this was basically broke out, but was put out fairly quickly. This was on pretty much the same day as what happened in Notre Dame. So there's footage showing smoke and fire emerging from the roof of the structure in the Marwani prayer room, or Solomon's Stables, as it's also called. And so this could be seen and was spread on social media, according to this Palestinian news agency, Mike. But yeah, so that happened on the same day. It didn't make a lot of headlines. I just thought it was a strange coincidence. But also this happened on Sunday. The Temple of Moscow Patriarch burned down in Ukraine, in Kharkov. So, and basically this was a Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarch burned down. Now, there could be political reasons for this with the current split in the autocephaly movement, which is being spurred on by Petro Poroshenko and some of the ultra-nationalists in the Ukraine, and certainly backed by the CIA. But I thought that was interesting. Right around the same time, this is a significant Orthodox church, Russian, aligned with Moscow, in the Ukraine. So these are happening all over, Mike. And but that was just, you know, I'm going to comment on this part of the story. This is probably the more unsavory part of the story. In the wake of the Notre Dame Cathedral, a number of stories, fake news stories, have been circulated, basically blaming this on Muslims, or using this Notre Dame fire to incite tension between the West and the Islamic world, so to speak. So, and there's a number of conservative commentators that were pushing various themes of this, including Matt Walsh, and also this sort of stuff appeared on InfoWars. This is Alex Jones's website, and Katie Hopkins. So they're basically, you know, putting out conspiracy theories that is deliberately started immediately. It could be arson, Mike, but they haven't done an investigation yet, okay? Mm-hmm. So anti-Christian attacks, etc. Katie Hopkins was far more explicit, according to this report in the Washington Post, claiming that Jewish and Christian Parisians are being hunted down, hunted out of the city by Islamists, fleeing in their thousands, and affixing the hashtag Notre Dame to that. And that's the amazing Katie Hopkins there. But we'll just carry on and see who else is involved in spreading this. Mike Cernovich tweeted that the West has fallen as soon as this news broke, and shortly after, the fast-talking far-right pundit Ben Shapiro called Notre Dame a monument to Western civilization and Judeo-Christian heritage. Of course, I wouldn't class Ben Shapiro as far-right per se, but that's a separate debate you can have that I'm sure people will be having in the chat box. But this one was the kicker. A parody Fox News account fabricated a tweet from Ilhan Omar saying they reap what they sow, hashtag Notre Dame. So a fake Fox News account was used. Here it is right here, Mike. So they basically, there's a few of these fake, they're parodying actual media outlets. And this is happening quite a lot now. And then they're putting out tweets. And of course, people who aren't very smart will just automatically look at the logo, but they won't look at the URL of the Twitter address. And so they'll just retweet it. So in this case, they're using this to sort of gin up West or Christian versus Muslim tension. So this is intentionally done. This is a coordinated campaign, and a lot of people are voluntarily taking part of it because they just like, people like to take part in these things, and they like to sort of go with the flow, even if it's fake news. Even friends of mine on Facebook were sending me memes and provocative memes today, basically insinuating that Muslims were, you know, behind this or somehow driving this fire in Notre Dame, Mike. So it's pretty shameful on many levels. But there's one more aspect of this here, pushing out ideas that Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota, was smiling inside, happy as a Muslim terrorist, giddy and laughing, and so forth. So this is all fabricated. And this is being done and coordinated and being retweeted and going viral immediately. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people taking part in this and willingly, basically. Glenn Beck also floated the possibility of a cover-up by France's government. He said, if this was started by Islamists, I don't think you'll find out about it because I think it would be set the whole country on fire. This is their World Trade Center moment.
Well, their World Trade Center moment. And of course, a number of the headlines talking about the twin towers of the of Notre Dame. So they're obviously encouraging this type of thinking.
Yeah, and trying to align those two ideas together.
And of course, if you look at what he said there, if this was started by Islamists, I don't think you'll hear about it. So the implication is that because there is an open borders policy which Macron supports, therefore he's supportive of Islam, and therefore if it was started by Islamists, he's not going to say anything in public because he likes the Islamic religion and so on. So this is a pretty dangerous narrative to be pushing out, isn't it?
Yeah, and Glenn Beck really pushes the clash of civilization narrative. That's one of his signatures. But this also plays in with the immigration issue, Mike. Mm-hmm. And why this story is very volatile with the right wing is because if you mix it with the immigration issue, you mix the Christian versus Islam in there. You can also transfer this into America, and there's a lot of media outlets, alternative media outlets, entertaining the idea that Muslims or Hezbollah is in Venezuela, even Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, but also alternative media outlets saying that ISIS is going to invade Texas via the southern border through Mexico. I mean, really wacky stuff. And there's like not just one, there's quite a few alternative media outlets reporting that idea. So this is perfect when you take that fake idea, that fantasy, that fabricated story, and you mix it with this, which is a hoax that's being pushed on social media by exclusively by sort of the right wing, with no other reason than to sort of ratchet up tensions and get people to hate each other. And really, this could lead to violence potentially. I'm not exaggerating. Mm. But this is the sort of thing that you do in advance of a war, Mike. Mm. This sort of fear-mongering, fake news, irrational clash of civilizations narratives, really ratcheting that up is what you do in advance of wars, especially if there's going to be an attack in the Middle East by the West or by Israel in the West. This would be the perfect way to kind of, push these things out for a long period of time so that when the war actually comes, people aren't too upset. It's like, don't worry about the Palestinians, you know, they sort of deserved it. They burned our churches down last month, so, you know, we can bomb them, it's okay, basically. I'm just giving you the basic psychology, because this is the psychology that the mainstream media works on. And if anybody has any objection to that, just go look at the news reports in advance of the Iraq War in 2003. I have a personal collection of those archives, and it's exactly what was seeded throughout the mainstream media for the years and months in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003. So that's why I'm worried when I see these things, Mike.
Okay, let's move on then to what was going on at the weekend outside Belmarsh Prison, Patrick.
So there was a protest in support of Julian Assange, who's just been incarcerated at Belmarsh Prison, a high security facility out in southeast London. And we went out there to report on this, Mike. And there was a number of people there who came, I think probably just over 100 for this. It was a last-minute event organized by a number of a coalition of various anti-war activists.
It's interesting that it was organized by a coalition of anti-war activists. Where are all the privacy campaigners and free speech campaigners in this?
A little bit slow to the punch, Mike.
Right.
They're a little bit slow. There were a few campaigners out there who were affiliated with organizations like this, but
right.
I mean, they didn't bring their troops with them.
Right.
And as far as I could see, Mike, Stop the War Coalition was like not there. Absent without leave, AWOL. No, I didn't see anything there. So I think they were made aware of this event, but they didn't show up for whatever reason. So that was a bit strange. But there are a few high-profile speakers, Mike, including Chris Williamson, the MP from Derby. And we actually got an exclusive interview with him on the Sunday Wire. That's up on 21stCenturyWire.com. He's a very good speaker, extremely knowledgeable, especially on foreign policy. So he gave a really good address to the crowd. And also former MP, former Labour MP, Respect MP, now a media talk show host both on radio and television, George Galloway, gave a thundering address to the crowd. We'll probably post that. A speech by Galloway and some of the other video clips up on 21wire.tv this week and later at 21stCenturyWire.com. But and it's also Lee Stranahan made it over from the United States. He's the host of Fault Lines, a radio show in Washington, D.C. That's also carried by Sputnik Radio. But that Lee's formerly with Breitbart News, Huffington Post. He's a serious journalist. He also gave an address to the crowd. I also spoke to the crowd as well for a couple of minutes. And we'll put those clips up at 21wire.tv a little bit later. So it was a good event, Mike, and there was some journalists down there as well. So there are a few stories circulating in the media. That's just the beginning. They're going to hold a 24-hour vigil as much as possible at the beginning anyway, which is just outside Belmarsh Prison. You can show your support in a number of ways for this, and you just go to Defend WikiLeaks or check out WikiLeaks' Twitter feed. And you can find places where you can help. And it's very easy to directly help this cause if you want to, because there's a legal fund for Julian Assange's defense. So it's very straightforward. But funny enough, Mike, as he's being incarcerated in Belmarsh, would you just believe it that he's also won an award?
Has he?
Yeah, what's that all about? So Julian Assange wins the EU Journalism Award. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been given an award established in the honor of an assassinated journalist. This is sponsored by the European Parliamentarians and was established in 2018 in honor of the assassinated Maltese journalist Daphne Galizia. And this was a high-profile murder, actually. It was a car bombing, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But Julian Assange has won this award. So isn't that interesting? He's recognized as an award-winning journalist. And just goes on to say this is an award given to individuals uncovering the truth and exposing it to the public and to the honor of the individuals or groups who've been intimidated and or persecuted for uncovering the truth and exposing it to the public. So, you know, what more do you need than that right there? That says it all, doesn't it? But this story is interesting, Mike, and I'll probably get your comment on this as well, because this is in the tech field, certainly something you know about. It's reported the country's deputy minister for information, we're talking about Ecuador here, in communications and technology, Patricio Real, claimed that the country's institutions are under attack, 40 million cyber attacks in the days since it effectively turned Assange in, or kicked him out of the embassy, revoked his asylum. This includes a number of DDoS, denial of service attacks, flooding a number of targets, including the president, the president's office itself.
Well, I got to say, first of all, that she is spoofing a little bit here. 40 million cyber attacks. Well, of course, you know yourself, a distributed denial of service attack. It might only be one attack, and you're getting hammered with
millions
of connections.
So that's
so she's counting every connection and saying 40 million cyber attacks. That's the first point.
Does that worry you, Mike? That she's the country's deputy minister of information and communication technologies, and she doesn't understand
I think she understands that
she
very
does.
Well, absolutely.
Okay. So she's hamming it up?
She is hamming it up. She understands exactly what it is, and she's able to pronounce a big number at that point. Mm-hmm. The other part of this is, can we believe what Ecuador says? Because so far they've come out with a dozen different excuses for why they expelled Assange in the first place. Everything from he was smearing feces on the walls, to it was because he released an image, a private image of the president eating lobster in his bed.
Yeah.
And so there were 100 different reasons which seemed to change on every 5 minutes. So I'm not quite sure whether we can believe a word of this either.
Yeah, there's a defamation, concerted defamation campaign going on. And I mean, I was on LBC. Radio, I think, on Sunday morning with Andrew Castle.
Right.
And they, straight out of the gates, it was all about Julian Assange's sex case in Sweden and, rape, sexual assault, etc. Should he be extradited to Sweden? So that was revived, this talk, the whole Sweden talking point. And there was a letter signed by, I think, 70 members of parliament, including Jess Phillips, basically saying that this would be a travesty to all women who have ever been a victim of rape if they don't extradite Julian Assange to Sweden. It will be a missed opportunity to, you know, he should be held to justice for what he's done, basically. He has not been charged ever with any sexual charge in Sweden. In fact, two different prosecutors dropped the case. It was last dropped in 2017, actually. So this idea that Julian Assange absconded from Sweden and ran from the law isn't true. The reason he took political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy was because he was aware of a potential extradition order to the United States. Okay, so that's, let's just get that straight. Okay, so be on the lookout for this, anything that defames him as a character, saying he hit embassy staff, he spread feces on the wall, he didn't do his dishes, he was mean to his cat, you know, whatever. All the trigger things, and add sexual assault to that as well. And, you know, how could any self-respecting feminist or liberal progressive support this evil man?
Yeah.
That's the whole sort of idea behind it.
Yeah.
So, sorry to say. But just one last thing on WikiLeaks, Mike. There's a bit of fake news that's been doing the rounds. And sadly, sometimes fake news goes viral. This is the fake news story that I caught. This is from a website called Nation and State. Not very reliable in terms of information. You can tell just by looking at their subheadings. But the URL on this, they've since printed a retraction after many people pointed out that this was a fake story. But this idea of a new WikiLeaks dump, in other words, WikiLeaks is getting revenge on the deep state. They're going to dump all of these. So they put out files, Mike, that were released in 2014, okay? But they marketed it as a new file dump. And, of course, nobody checked whether this was new or old files. These were old files. It's very easy to tell their old files, Mike. Do you know how you do it?
You click on the link, which takes you back to the WikiLeaks website, and you can look at the date.
Well, sometimes the date's not visible on the WikiLeaks page.
Right.
So then you just take the link and you copy it, and you paste it into the Wayback Machine, and then you can see when it was first published. And it's really difficult, and my 9-year-old nephew doesn't have any problem doing it, but apparently a lot of adults out there struggle with sort of basic web tools and search engines, so they have no idea of knowing how old any document is. So they just keep pushing and spreading the viral fake story, the fake story that WikiLeaks and Assange is, you know, everything's... But if you listen, if you watch QAnon, everything's fine. Just trust the plan.
Okay.
If you follow QAnon, ignore everything that we're saying, and just you can just sit back, relax, you know.
Trust the plan.
Trust the plan.
NATO has a plan. So here's NATO's plan. They held an exercise called Locked Shields. This was a couple of days ago. A team of nearly 40 NATO cybersecurity experts were competing from over the last few days in Locked Shields 2019. This was held in Estonia, and it was organized by the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence. It used a game-based approach, apparently, although it was what they describe as a live fire cyber exercise, whatever that means. So the scenario was that a fictitious country, Karelia, faced coordinated cyber attacks against the civilian infrastructure while it was holding a national election. So that's good stuff. And the job of NATO's team was to help contain the damage and protect the networks from further attacks. So, you know, they're clearly doing a fantastic job. I'm highly impressed.
Election meddling,
yes.
So this is all based on the idea that the Russians are meddling in elections.
You may say that. They don't say that. They say it's a fictitious country.
Right. Even though the whole election meddling has been debunked in America, but they've still managed to design whole NATO drills, and they're spending tens of millions of dollars, Mike, rehearsing on things based on scenarios that have been debunked, right?
Yes.
That's a good way to spend our money.
Brilliant. Yeah. And here's another fantastic way to spend our money, because NATO's been holding more exercises, this time in the Black Sea. This is Romania was hosting this particular exercise Sea Shield. More than 20 ships and crews from Romania, Bulgaria, Canada, Greece, the Netherlands and Turkey. Five ships from the standing NATO Maritime Group 2. This is just finished a couple of days ago. Sea Shield was designed to practice joint warfare tactics and techniques used against underwater surface and air threats. And of course, in the Black Sea, so not insightful at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, let's move on. Here's Andrew Rossendale, because he's quite interested to know what the British government is doing to support the Ukrainians. So we weren't particularly involved in this exercise in the Black Sea, but we are still helping Ukrainian defense and security. That's very important. So this was answered yesterday by Mark Lancaster, who said this: the UK remains a steadfast partner to Ukraine as it faces continued acts of aggression and threats to its sovereignty. British personnel have been involved in training mission Operation Orbital since February 2015. In this time, they've trained over 13,000 members of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. During a visit in September 2018, the Secretary of State for Defence extended Operation Orbital to March 2020. He went on to say, this year, Operation Orbital has delivered support and mentoring to the Ukrainian Navy through training teams consisting of personnel from the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and the Army. The UK and the Ukrainian Armed Forces will also gain further opportunities to develop capability and share expertise by committing to bilateral and multilateral exercises later this year. And that's not designed to incite Russia either.
No, it's not. They trained 13,000 Ukrainian soldiers, Mike. I think that's quite a lot of soldiers. Oh, did they say what they actually trained them in?
No.
Did they get certificates?
They didn't specify.
Or participation medals?
I'm sure they got those, yes.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I'm sure Russia's extremely worried, however, about this. Really?
Well, I think,
symbolically, yes.
Symbolically, yes. But, yes, that's exactly the point.
But they're really playing games in the Black Sea, Mike. I remember Gavin Williamson saber-rattling before Christmas.
Right.
After the Kerch Strait incident.
Right.
I mean, it was just totally over the top, basically, that we're going to get in there and show the Russians we mean business and send our one boat
Yeah, HMS Echo.
HMS Echo.
Yeah, it's the one that they sent.
We're serious.
Totally.
Yeah, putting you on notice, Putin.
Well, look, let's just mention the war, which everybody forgets about, which, of course, is Yemen. And this was being tweeted out today. Famine is crushing children in Yemen as the whole world stands still to the suffocating siege imposed on the country. Well, that's quite interesting timing, because yesterday Karen Pierce was in the United Nations giving a speech. Well, she was saying basically there have been some very welcome pledges from Saudi Arabia and UAE, but there's still a $1.5 billion funding gap in the humanitarian response plan. So basically what this is that Saudi Arabia has now offered $200 million to go to the humanitarian response plan. So they bomb the country to bits, they cause the famine. But that's okay, because they're putting $200 million into a humanitarian response, but there's still a funding gap. So obviously Karen Pierce a little bit upset about that. But I also wanted to highlight this article in Mint Press. Despite human rights abuses in Yemen, Saudi soldiers receiving UK military training. So apparently, not only are we training people in Ukraine, but we're training Saudis as well. So the Mint Press article here is saying 40 Saudi military cadets have been receiving training in British military colleges amid human rights abuse reports against the Gulf States forces in Yemen. And this is training that's going on at Sandhurst and also at the Royal Air Force School at Cranwell and the Royal Navy College. And so Jeremy Hunt, recently the article reporting criticised Germany for halting arms sales to Saudi Arabia following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and so on. So, you know, we are training people all around the world, which seem to be acting as what proxies for us. So we have the Ukrainian military acting as proxies for us against Russia. And Saudi seems to be doing our job in Yemen as well. We clearly want to support Saudi in the work, but there is a little bit of cost for doing business, because you've got to put a little bit of effort into some kind of humanitarian crusade, which isn't really solving anything for the Yemenis, because they're starving to death.
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia is kind of just replicating the U.S. model, which is then to sort of start a war, do a lot of damage, then go in to do the rebuilding effort, make profit along the way where you can. The U.S. is making profit in this case on the sort of arms side. Britain's making profit on the arms side. Mm-hmm. And then eventually our NGOs will also, and the contractors that supply the food and all the blankets and the rebuilding, a lot of these will be Western companies. So they're looking at Yemen as a major cash cow, Mike, for the West in terms of rebuilding its infrastructure. And of course, the kind and compassionate hand of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia will swoop in to lift the poor Yemenis out of the abject poverty that was caused by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia itself and its allies behind the scenes, the US and the UK. But what's the point of it, Mike? Besides that, what is the point? The point is, it's outsourcing. So rather than having a major U.S. military component in the Persian Gulf, the U.S. doesn't need it. It has now built up the Saudi Arabian military machine to a sufficient level, trained enough pilots, run enough sorties that they'll be able to sort of perform missions on behalf of the United States and their allies going forward. In this case, we're looking at Iran as a potential target.
Right.
So that's what this is about.
And as that article says, not just the United States training, but also the U.K. training Saudi personnel as well. So,
and Israel as well. They're also involved,
right,
in certain jobs and certain things. Yeah.
Well, speaking of Israel, here's a nice little article on Haaretz. Is this good news, Patrick?
Well, this could very well be the last stop on the global award junket tour for the White Helmet. So the U.S. Holocaust Museum has given an award to Syrian Volunteer Aid Group. I love how they've packaged the White Helmets there. So here's the propaganda. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is given the highest honor to the Syrian Civil Defense. Of course, they're not the Syrian Civil Defense. They're called the White Helmets. They stole the name serious civil defense from the real serious civil defense, which actually exists in Syria and has been a member of the International Civil Defense Organization since, I believe, 1953. And again, a volunteer group, that's also a lie. They're paid. The White Helmets are paid. They're in it for the money. That's clear. We've done a number of interviews. Vanessa Bealey as well has documented this, as have others. So anyway, to operate in rebel-controlled areas in Syria and Turkey. Rebel-controlled areas of Turkey? That's interesting, Mike. A little snippet there from Haaretz. I didn't realize there were any rebel-controlled areas of Turkey.
I knew there were Syrian rebels, in inverted commas, in Turkey, but I didn't realize that they controlled Turkish areas.
This is a copy and paste job right out of the White Helmets press office. So the Western countries view it as a humanitarian organization. No, that's a lie. They don't view it. They fund it. They created it. They fund it. They pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into this fake search and rescue pseudo-NGO. But Russia claims this press release, which supports Bashar al-Assad's government, has described the group as a threat. I don't know if that's actually true. They've described it as a propaganda construct, and who are basically creating a lot of material for Western mainstream media. But let's just remind everybody, here's an article, one of many at 21st Century Wire, the real Syria civil defense saving real Syrians, not Oscar-winning White Helmets saving Al-Qaeda. Okay, and this is a quote here from someone in the real Syrian civil defense. He says, when the real Syrian civil defense are working, attending a rescue, they must divorce from their emotions in order to be 100% effective standard operating procedure, Mike, for any real first responder. Okay, so when we see the White Helmets working, they're acting, performing for the camera. It is not real, and they're shouting Allah Akbar every 2 seconds. As well, so it's acting, it's emotion. That's what the Western media want from the White Helmets, and it's not what they'll get from the real Syria civil defense.
Okay, well, over the last couple of days, Patrick, obviously there have been some protests in London run by this group, Extinction Rebellion, and so you're proposing a novel idea.
Well, I just, you know, when you've run out of ideas for so-called environmental campaigners, why not attack public transport?
Well, hold on, aren't environmental campaigners supposed to be for public transport?
I used to think so, Mike, but you know, we live in strange times, and this is a very strange organization, Extinction Rebellion. So instead of encouraging people to celebrate public transport, which has been going since the 1920s, I'm talking about the London Underground, they're attacking public transport. Not just tubes, Mike. Buses as well.
Well, absolutely. So here's the BBC saying Extinction Rebellion London protesters climb on top of DLR train. Somebody also glued himself to a bus. So that was going on. But one of the things that fascinated me about this, Patrick, was this. Obviously, we've had lots and lots of tweets about Extinction Rebellion, and the catchphrase that we're talked that's in all of these is, there's no planet B. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the plan B? They ask, there's no planet B. We need a plan B. Okay. And I was fascinated by this because this is all from Extinction Rebellion types. Well, this gentleman was giving a speech yesterday. This is Sir James Bevan, who's the chief executive of the Environment Agency. And he said, my original working title for this speech was, Is Climate Change the New Brexit? My point was that it's not. You can worry about Brexit if you want, but you'll be worrying about the wrong thing. And he goes on to say that there are plenty of opportunities. There are plenty of opportunities in this. We all know that you'd never waste a good crisis if, like Brexit, climate change has created an unfrozen moment where we're not politically possible, where what was not politically possible now becomes essential. There's an opportunity to craft new policies that will lift us for, that will fit us for a climate change future. And a better one. Many want something bigger to believe in that they can work towards. And this is what he said, climate change could provide that rallying point because while there may or may not turn out to be a plan B for Brexit, there is no planet B for us. So here we have the head of the Environment Agency using the same language as the Extinction Rebellion. And so I'm going to ask at this point, Patrick, is this that he is echoing their language because he likes their campaign, or is it that they're echoing language which is coming out of actually policy papers from government in the first place? So I ask the question, what is Extinction Rebellion? Is it, in fact, a government sort of run campaign in the first place, or a government-inspired campaign in the first place?
Well, I think it's a good point you've brought up here, Mike. In terms of Sir James Bevan, he clearly made the statement there that, you know, we can't let a good crisis go to waste.
Right.
The famous mantra of Rahm Emanuel, Obama, Barack Obama's former chief of staff. So he's basically saying, no, hold it back to a point where we can really maximize and get a lot of use out of this crisis, okay? So it's already politicized from that point.
Right.
It's already a political tool. But the question is, you're asking, you know, is who's scratching whose back?
Correct.
Here, right?
That's the question.
And I think in this case, Mike, it's a mutual recognition between this activist campaign and government. The government's looking, so how can we use this activist campaign to sort of further things that we want to further for the industries that are giving us money, lobbyists and so forth, who are, you know, pumping money into the system and who we own shares in, and what, how can we get rich out of it? Okay.
Well, that's exactly the point of the speech.
Yes. And the activists are saying, how can we push the buttons of the government so that they, you know, put us higher on their priority list? So it's a total symbiotic relationship. But you said that's exactly what was in there.
Absolutely. The speech as a whole is all about how people, including NGOs and campaign groups, can take advantage of the situation. It came across to me as I read it in general as there's lots of money to be made here if you push the right buttons.
Yeah, and I'm not being too cynical by saying it is an industry, by the way. The NGO industry is an industrial complex. We've been saying this for quite a few years, okay? The problem is, like the charity industry, is there anybody out there that's going to deny that the charity is an industry? Mm. The CEOs are getting millions in some cases, okay? And so it is definitely, it's an elite-oriented industry, okay? And it's to build status, to launder reputations of oligarchs and criminals who want to sort of clean their image as well. I mean, and to make politicians look good. So no one's going to deny in the charity sector, Mike, that exists. But somehow with the NGOs and other activist organizations and foundations, people are kind of still in denial, saying, yeah, we understand the charity sector is corrupt, but the NGO is not. Mm. Basically, this is the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. They're NGOs. Charity is an NGO. It's the same thing. So.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, look, we're out of time, Patrick, so we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, we're off for the Easter break, so there'll be no UK Column News on Friday or Monday. We will be back next Wednesday, which is the 24th, I believe. So we will see you then. And we hope everybody has a great Easter in the meantime. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.